And I'll read that again. I know two types of law because I know two types of men, those who are with us and those who are against us. And that was him in 1933, Hermann Göring. And, of course, most folks realize that in 1933, there was a Reichstag fire, which is the equivalent of the German Congress, the German law body. It would be the equivalent of, we have here in Washington, D.C., where the Congress meets and so forth. And they had a fire at that time, and Hitler seized upon that. He said the terrorists did that, and he went, said, we need to resist these terrorists, and I need all the power that I can possibly get to ensure the safety of the German people. And many precedents were set up for centralizing power with the government, for restricting the freedoms of the German people. And very similar language was used. They even had an office of the homeland, slightly different title in German and so forth. They set up a kind of a national security oversight, just like we have here with the Homeland Security. The parallels are just shockingly similar. And people say, well, it could never happen here in the United States, but I would suggest that perhaps it won't happen exactly the same way, but there's certain lessons that can be learned from what happened in Germany in the 30s and what is going on here now. Germany at the time was one of the most well-educated, enlightened countries in Europe. They had tremendous historical background, rich in philosophy, music, science. They were really at the top of you might say, just awareness. And yet, it happened there in Germany. And can it happen here in America? Well, I would suggest that that it is happening in part, and if we in America do not start to understand some of the basics of how freedom actually functions there and how government is supposed to function, why we have some of the limitations upon government that we do, then I'm concerned that our freedoms will continue to slip away. I talk quite a bit about the income tax system. The income tax system is basically incompatible with freedom. You just have such an invasive presence with the government. How in the world could you possibly be free if you're supposed to reveal every literal aspect of your life to some outside authority? You can't be free in that kind of situation. You have no real privacy. You're not free when you're compelled to do that sort of thing. You do not have a choice in the matter. Are you really free in that situation? So I think the parallels between what happened in Germany and what's happened the last 3 years is something to be drawn upon. And I could really get into the details of this, but if you have any thoughts on this, I would certainly like to hear them. I know to a lot of people, say that's a vast overstatement, but when you look at what's really happened with this Patriot Act, it's incredible at this point in time what has been allowed to pass as legality and lawful and so forth. And I think our Constitution has greatly suffered. They're doing incredible things. People who are citizens of the United States who have spoken out are increasingly being supervised, and as I said, it's only going to continue to get worse. There's talk now of Patriot Act number 2 on the horizon, which has even more draconian strikes against our freedoms. So the precedent is there. It's building. The momentum is building. And now with this Iraqi war for freedom that we're having, and the momentum that's building up, and all the hurrah, hurrah that you're hearing on the radio, the fever, the pitch, it's creating kind of the same mood as occurred in Germany. Hitler, when he got up to speak, It wasn't fraudulent that the people were wildly, enthusiastically clapping for him. He was quite an orator, and he knew where the passions of the people were, and he got up and he spoke. You have to give the devil his due, and Hitler became quite an orator during his time, and he really moved the passions of the American, of the German people. Now, the passions of the American people are definitely being fanned. You see, all the commentators, you spin the radio dial, all the talk shows, certainly the corporate media, you spin the dial, and they're all Bill O'Reilly, Rush Limbaugh, all of them. You just spin the dial, and they're all enthusiastically backing the war, as if there isn't any other perspective, as if there isn't something else that we could and should be doing as a nation. So they're really playing upon the passions of the American people, and it's really it's been said many, many times that those who do not know history are doomed to repeat it. Could it all happen again? It's my concern that not only could it happen again, I believe that we're well on our way towards it happening again. And the only thing that I know as a person, as an average citizen here, that we can do to change things is to just educate ourselves as much as we can, and then take that information and share it with as many people as we can. People talk about politics as being nasty, dirty, unspiritual, and so forth. Well, I think it's just the opposite. I think politics is about one of the, it's the way to make spirituality, your religion, your soul inside of you, it's a way to make it real, because it has everything to do with how we choose to live as a people. Well, this is Tom Cloney. It's been my privilege to be with you again. I'll be back here next Monday at 7 o'clock. Thank you very much.
How are you doing?
All righty. Doing my best.
Yeah. People out there listening, because here in Santa Cruz, people in Santa Cruz probably are.
Wonder what's happening in every other place.
Yes. Hey,
you're
going to talk to Ed Griffin
tonight,
huh?
Yeah, he's got a new program, and looking forward to it.
Do you have any new book on the horizon?
For me, no. I got a new, great new syllabus, this new syllabus on Iran, the Untold Story. Prelude to World War III is really pretty good, even if I do say so. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming at it from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us a very, very special guest. I first met Ed Griffin in December of 1962, so that's, that's over 20 years ago, 40 years ago, and he came to my house and gave a talk. And that was one of the most forceful, dramatic talks I've ever heard, and it played a very important part in bringing me into the conservative movement. And now, of course, here we are 41 years later or 40 years later, and I'm doing talk radio. And Ed, of course, has always been the thinker. He has always been coming up with ideas and concepts, dealing with what's going on in the world and how can we make for a better world? How can we preserve the freedom that we inherited from generations past so it can be passed on to generations yet unborn? And so without further ado, I want to introduce a writer, a philosopher, a speaker, certainly known throughout America, and one of my favorite guests, Ed Griffin. Ed, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you for the very kind introduction, Stan. It fills me with nostalgia to remember those days. You're right, that was 1962, wasn't it?
Right, 1962. Well, here we are now, 40 years later, and of course you've been trying to figure out what we can do, how we can perhaps recapture the land that we grew up in, the land that offered so much opportunity to people, the land that stood for righteousness and justice. So I'm going to just let you go ahead and talk.
Well, thank you, Stan. I don't know quite where to begin. I feel like the proverbial mosquito in a nudist colony. You know? I know what I have to do. I just don't know where to begin. I have been, as you said, splashing around in these topics for over 40 years. And one of the things that became obvious about midway through that period of time is that I and so many others who were concerned about our vanishing freedoms in America were spending a lot of time talking about how bad things are, but very seldom did we really have a solution or a counter-proposal. And it prompts me to give you my two-minute seminar on apathy. In those days, in the 60s and early 70s, I had the experience of telling people this is going wrong and that is going wrong and we have this problem and that problem, and I was very upset about the trend of the day. But many of my victims, I shall call them that, would look at me and very quickly they'd get a glazed look in their eye, and it seemed like they were anxious to get out of the conversation. And occasionally they'd say, well, you know, what are you going to do about it? Can't fight City Hall, that's the way it's going to be, and you can't do anything about it. And they seem to be more interested in their golf game and making money, and no one seemed to take on the kind of alarm that I had. And I remember thinking at the time how apathetic the American people are, and I used to kind of throw the blame on them for a long time, thinking that somehow they just didn't see the light, that they were substandard characters or something. Then, Stan, one day I realized that I was the problem and not them. And the reason I say that is because I realized, I used this analogy in my own mind to come to this self-realization. If we were in a life raft out in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, there's a rubber raft and there's a small pinhole leak in the bottom of it, and we know that because we can see the bubbles coming up around the edge. And there's no way we can stop that leak. And we just think ahead, my gosh, this raft can only last maybe another 8 or 9 hours with that leak, and then we're going down. So what you would see if we were in that raft, you would see the perfect picture of apathy. We would lie there and we would do nothing. We would just wait for our fate to happen because there was nothing we could do. But if we looked around the raft and we saw that there was an air pump attached to it and a place to screw the nozzle in, then all of a sudden we wouldn't be apathetic anymore. We would be the picture of energy. We'd be pumping away with all of our energy for whatever hours or days or weeks of time we had before we just faded away. We'd be working diligently to save ourselves. And the only difference between those two pictures of apathy and activism is that in the first case there was no hope, and in the second case there was hope. And I suddenly realized that I had done such a good job of explaining all of these problems to my friends that I had convinced them that there was absolutely no hope, that nothing could be done about it. And so I had transplanted this state of apathy into their minds. And boy, from that time forward, I realized that this was a terrible thing I had done, and I resolved to always try and couple my discussions, if anybody's interested in discussing these things with me, I'd couple them with solutions, or at least positive ideas, alternatives. Now, the only problem with that is, and I have to be honest about it now in retrospect, that for many years following that, even though I did offer what I considered to be positive solutions, I really deep in my heart didn't think that they were going to work. I really had a kind of a pessimistic outlook that the powers that were on the other side were so great and so entrenched and had so much momentum that there was no way in the world that I, or anybody else for that matter, was going to wrench this power away from them and really turn the tide in time. But I kind of kept my happy face on because I felt that, well, you know, who knows, there might be a miracle. And my job was to keep the hope there, to keep the light burning, to continue to spread the word, and maybe if we could enlighten enough people and enough quickly in a, you know, short enough time, that maybe we could build a counter-resistance, and maybe we could turn this thing around. But that was always sort of up front, and it was kind of a public relations show, and I tried to talk myself into believing it, which, well, I have believed it. But, you know, deep down underneath, I always suspected that it was too late. Now, I make that little confession now because that's changed. That was, you know, goes back to the 60s and 70s and early 80s. But what happened, it's kind of funny this topic is coming up because I was going through my computer just last night and came across a note that I had entered into it in 1993. And I had forgotten about it. It was the turning point in my thinking. And it was in my journal, and I'd completely forgotten about it. And in that note, I said to myself, what we need to do is see how our opponents have captured control of the power centers of society, how they have succeeded, and to figure out how to do the same thing in reverse and still maintain an ethical position. Of course, we know that the opponents of freedom will use all kinds of tactics. They'll use murder, bribery, blackmail, deceit, you know, all of these things. We can't and wouldn't want to use any of those tactics. But they also use other tactics which are not unethical at all and which are quite brilliant in their execution. And the main thing is that they have set about to capture control of what they call the power centers of society. Now, they actually, we'll come back in a moment if you wish and talk about who they are, but there are two groups out there that are actively seeking control of the world. They both have common goals, but they compete with each other for dominance. But both of them have the same tactic of trying to acquire control over the power centers of society. And they have schools on this and textbooks and training manuals on how to do that. And when I say power centers of society, I'll define it as they do. They define a power center as any group or organization that has active membership and which has enough influence in public affairs that the leaders are listened to by the political centers of society, and as they say, the sum total of power of all of these organizations is the sum total of power of the nation. Now, those organizations are such things as political parties, labor unions, church organizations, educational associations, PTAs, you know, Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, all of the many, many organizations that people belong to or support. Or the human being is kind of a herd animal. We have a herd instinct. And if the group is doing something, we have this tendency to say, well, I guess that's correct. We take support from the fact that there are others doing this. And so we move as groups. Our enemies have known this for so many years. And so therefore, instead of trying to convince every man, woman, and child to do what they want them to do, what they have done is to reach for control of the apex of these organizations to which people belong. If they can capture the leadership positions of the organizations in a society, then they can move the leadership positions and the masses will follow. So that is why we find that these people, although their numbers are always less than 3% and usually less than 1% of the population, they can literally move every nation in the world to follow in the direction that they want it to do. So this idea began to bubble up in my mind back in 1993. And anyway, just to make a, you know, I could talk forever on this, and maybe we will tonight, but...
We've only got 2 hours, Ed, but...
Only 2 hours. Well, I'll have to start cutting this short then, because literally I gave a seminar Sunday in La Cañada, and we spent 6 hours on this. And we ran out of time. But I was quite amazed. Those poor souls stuck with me all the way to the end. But I do believe that some of these concepts are new to many, even those of us who have been in the battle for many, many years. So that in kind of an outline form, Stan, is what I'm working on. And the significant element, there are many elements that are different, but the most significant difference between what I am trying to do now in an organization called Freedom Force International, the main difference is that we are reaching for power. Reaching for power. Now, that is the thing that I used to think in my earlier days in this movement was something that we should not do. I thought that having power and influence in society somehow was contrary to the principles of freedom. I remember quite distinctly telling people, no, we are opposed to power, we are opposed to concentrations of power, and therefore we ourselves must reject power. And I actually believe that, and of course some aspects of that are true, but not all aspects of it. And one morning, I remember it very clearly, it was about 4 o'clock in the morning, probably about 1993, at the same time all of this was coming together in my subconscious mind. I remember sitting up in bed, all of a sudden woke up, and I remember my wife tells me that I said out loud the words, "We lose." And it was because I was thinking, if we reject power constantly, there is no way that we can win in this struggle against power. Every entrenched power in the world has never been overthrown unless it was by equal or greater power. You know, even in the American Revolution, that was power that had to be overthrown by equal or greater power. Well, it was a military power, but nevertheless, it was power. And had the colonies not been organized, had they not had governmental units in place, did they not have the structure of political and military power in the colonies, they could not have beaten the British. And I don't care what example you want to look at throughout history, all of the entrenched tyrannies of history would still be with us today if it weren't for the fact that somewhere along the line there was another power that came up that was equal to or greater than theirs, and they were toppled by it.
Well, you know, I think that's really so, too, and I think we have to really learn from the other side because there's nothing that succeeds like success. If they're succeeding and we're not, then what are we doing is wrong. And, you know, many years ago I read, and I'm sure you remember the book very well, Between Two Ages by Zbigniew Brzezinski.
Oh, yes.
And, of course, Robert Welch, who, you know, I was a brilliant individual, but he always used to say, we don't want to use radio and television. We want to use books to reach people and make them understand what's going on. And Zbigniew Brzezinski, in his book Between Two Ages, said, We want to use radio and television. We want to use the electric medium to reach the minds of the people, because that's how we're going to spread our doctrine. You know, I looked and saw the two sides, the one that was trying to use books. How do you get people to use books unless they know there's a problem? And then the success of the other side that was using the electronic media, radio and television. And this was back, I suppose, in somewhere in the 1970s. I think that book came out in the early 70s. And I said, They're winning and we're losing. We need to try to use the electronic media as well. And so that's why that idea in my mind was, well, at least somehow we have to counter at least a voice on the other side. And amazing how things came together. So I'm doing what I'm doing. Certainly we're a small voice, but at least we're a voice. And there are lots of other small voices out there that at least are reaching some people with an understanding of what's going on. But as you point out, simply understanding what's going on is not going to solve our problem. Then the question is, once you understand what's going on, how do you keep from falling into total despair? How do you put your knowledge to work? And that's what you're really talking about. So,
well, yes, and I'd like to add a little of my own insight to this apparent chasm between Zbigniew and Welch, Brzezinski and Welch. It may not be as wide as you might think. You know, there are two levels of information, or two levels of concepts. I think concept is a better word. When you're dealing with principles, concepts, ideologies, and we'll come back to that later. I hope you'll let me come back to this great divide between collectivism and individualism, which is what I see as the great ideology split that divides most men. The forces that want to rule the world usually don't advertise that in the media. They do this in books and private lectures, and it's a very intellectual experience. They come to the conclusion that they are collectivists, they want to rule the world for the benefit of the world, or on our side we come to the conclusion that we are individualists and we want freedom in the world, and therefore we have to give up our own option of forcing others to do what we want them to do. These are highly intellectual experiences that people come to conclusions on ideological principles, and then they try and become influential in the power centers of society to implement those principles that they believe in. And once they have done that, then they're interested in the media in order to get the masses to follow their programs, but not necessarily to sell their ideologies to the masses. You follow what I'm trying to say?
Absolutely.
The collectivists have, whether we're talking about the Fabians or whether we're talking about the Leninists, they very seldom go on to television or use the mass media to advertise and promote their ideology. This is done mostly for the private groups and for the books and the study groups and that kind of thing. Only after they are in positions of influence, only then do they use the media to try and convince the public to follow the platforms that are based on those principles.
All right, we're going to be back here in just a moment with Ed Griffin, and we'll take calls maybe the next hour. Well, our guest this evening is Ed Griffin, and as I said earlier, I've known Ed for 40 years, and he is, of course, talking about how, of course, we communicate ideas. First of all, to get people to know there's a problem, to understand the problem, but then, of course, to reach the masses, and that's really what the media is. The only thing I've found, though, that occasionally, if we talk and tell the truth, occasionally people will hear it and they'll say, I don't believe a word of it, but I'm going to check and find out if it's true. And, of course, that's the worst thing they can do, because when they find out it's true, they have two choices. Either they become involved or to do nothing, and hopefully many of them will decide to join this epic struggle to determine whether this nation or any nation conceived in freedom under God can long endure. So why don't you pick up the story from there, Ed?
Well, yes, I think that it's important for people to know what they are for as well as what they are against. Now, a lot of people have said that over the years, but having said that, it's not so easy to come up with a statement of what is it that we are for. I have always felt that that was one of the missing links in our program to oppose totalitarianism. We've never had a creed. We've never had a clear statement of principles that we could say, this I believe, and I believe it for this reason, and this reason, and this reason. Anybody want to debate it? You know, who among us can stand up and define what freedom is based on, what it really is? Some people say, well, we turn to the Constitution. But how many people know what the Constitution says? And maybe they read the words, but what are the ethics in it? What are the principles in it? And even some of those, you know, are kind of vaguely stated, because the Constitution, as wonderful as it was a compromise document. And sometimes the clear principles that some of the founding fathers wanted written into that statement had to be watered down in order to get the majority approval. And I think that was an amazing accomplishment that they got anything agreed upon, and the fact that they got as much sound principle in there as they did, but the fact remains, it's not a perfect document. It just happens to be the best stab at it that the world has ever seen so far. But I look at the Constitution as kind of a guidepost. Okay, this is a great start. Now let's learn from this and improve on it if we can. I think one of the weaknesses of the United States Constitution is that the principles were not extracted from it and laid out in terms that people could study. They were certainly embedded into the Constitution, but they were embedded in terms of political structures. And the principles themselves, if you want to find out what they are, you've got to go to the Federalist Papers, you've got to go to the debates at the Constitutional Convention, you've got to go to the words of the men at the time they were writing the Constitution to really get at the principles. And I've often felt that it's too bad had they said, well, this Constitution is based on a set of principles, and here are the principles, let's study those first, and then we'll see how we implemented them in the Constitution. I thought, boy, wouldn't that have been nifty? But, you know, considering that that was really the first time in history that a document of that caliber was produced, I think they did an amazingly good job. But
I think they did, too, and we're going to have to just wait here for a moment until our listeners up in the Great Northwest rejoin us. They've been waiting for a few minutes, but they'll be back here in just a moment as we listen to Ed Griffin. Well, our guest this evening is Ed Griffin. We're talking about the Constitution and really what an amazing, amazing document it is. And yet, of course, no document ever conceived of by man is perfect. And yet it was, as Ed said, the greatest document that was ever written, and amazing that it was able to lay out the ideas as well as it did. But one of the big problems was that a lot of people, at least today, don't understand the Constitution. They don't even understand what freedom's all about.
Well, that's right, and you don't necessarily get that just from reading the Constitution. You can read the Constitution and you think, well, what was that all about? Because you really have to go back to the debates and to the thinking of the men that wrote the Constitution before you understand why that particular clause was in there. And I used to fret over that. I thought, gee, next time around, if there ever is a next time around, someone's got to put the principles down. And not only that, though, having the written down on a piece of paper doesn't do any good if no one reads them. And I assumed that if people just read the Constitution, even as imprecise as some parts of it are, if every child in school were required to recite a part of the Constitution every day in school, maybe a paragraph of it, and they just keep rotating through there, you know, that we probably still have a pretty good handle on the Constitution. But of course, nobody did that, and they still don't do it, and nobody reads the Constitution. So naturally, the fire of it has gone out, and it's pretty much stepped all over the place. And I thought, well, how can you ever write a document and have people read it and understand it so that it will go into the future forever? And I thought, well, I guess you just can't do it. It just can't be done, and that was it. I was filled with despair. And then one day I got the answer in the most unlikely of places. Stan, I attended a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was very impressed by what I saw there. I expected not to be impressed. I expected to be embarrassed, as a matter of fact, but I wasn't. These are very wonderful people, and they have overcome their problem, and they stand up and they tell you, you know, this is the way it was, and this is what happened to me, and this is the way it is now. And I was so impressed by all this And I was listening to this, and I thought, boy, this is wonderful. And there was another fellow there who also was a first-time attendee along with me. And at the end of the meeting, he raised his hand. He said, you know, this is a great meeting. You people are doing such good work. Why don't you go on television and put this program on television or at least radio so you can spread the word, reach so many more people? And almost to a person in the group, they said, no, 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 sit down, you're wrong, you don't understand. It's against the rules. Now, that really caught my ear. I said, against the rules? What rules? Well, I inquired, and they have not really an official set of rules, but it's something I think they call the Big Book, and it was written by the two founders of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they went into great detail, just like our founding fathers did in their debates leading up to the Constitution. They wrote in this book all of their thinking, all of their arguments, pro and con, on so many issues, and especially such things as would be acceptable for Alcoholics Anonymous to do. And one of them was that they felt that the best way to make AA work is to be very private, one-on-one, and that therefore they must always shun any publicity, any kind of media. Has to be a very private thing, just one-on-one, and they said, that's the way it's going to be, folks. And I said, well, how come everybody really knows that? And they said, well, you see, at every meeting, it is required by tradition that someone stand up and read a couple of paragraphs or maybe a page out of the Big Book. And they just keep going through it over and over and over again. And so every member of AA has got to listen to all of this rationale every meeting, over and over and over again, and they're never allowed to forget the rules. And I walked out of there saying, that's it. That's it. That's what we're going to do. We'll get our rules written down, and we will require it by tradition for anybody in our organization that whenever there's a meeting of 20 people or more, a portion of the code of conduct, or we call it the code of conduct, must be read aloud. And that's the way that these principles that we have embedded into the organization, we hope, will be perpetuated into the future forever.
All right, fine. Well, of course, now, what are these principles, and what is the organization that you're thinking of? And we've only got about 30 seconds before we have to go to the half-hour break, but I'll pick it up from there.
Well, I'll give you 30 seconds worth. All right. The organization is called Freedom Force International, and we already have members in the United States, Canada, New Zealand, and Australia. That does not mean we're an internationalist-minded organization. We're just as concerned about national sovereignty as anyone, but we do know that a freedom movement in any one country will be more effective if it is networked with similar freedom movements in other countries.
All right, we'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Ed Griffin, and we're talking about Freedom Force International, an organization that Ed has been working on for a long time, and now it's coming to fruition, and so pick up the story from there, Ed.
Well, yes, it actually has started. After all these years, it's finally come together. And as I said a moment ago, we have members now in four countries, and I'm sure that we'll have more very soon. As a matter of fact, this may surprise you, I think we may have a unit starting in Russia very soon. Because, you know, in some countries where they have experienced naked, raw totalitarianism, they understand these issues even more than here in America, where we've been pretty shielded from it all of our lives.
I think you're absolutely right. I don't think most Americans value their freedom. Oh, they say they do, but of course they're really not willing to sacrifice for it, whereas the people who've lived under totalitarian value freedom far more and guard their freedom far more than the average American, who's always willing to accept the new series of regulations or instructions or laws that come down from people who are violating their oath when they vote for laws that restrict the freedom of the individual. For, as Thomas Jefferson had said so well, in matters of politics, speak not to me of confidence in men, but bind them down for mischief, with the change of the Constitution, because the whole idea of our system of government was to limit the power of a government over the lives of the people. And they recognized that liberty and limited government were synonymous, and a government that can provide whatever we need and regulate whatever we have has to be able to control everything we have, and that's the direction we're headed today.
Well, that's certainly true. When I put these thoughts down some time ago, I said to myself, I got to make a list of what is needed to turn these things around and to really to be victorious against these forces of totalitarianism. And I came up with what I thought were a pretty good list of eight things. Now, let me just tick them off here. They're pretty obvious, most of them. The first one is that there's not much that can be done by one person alone. I think that's one of the problems. So many people out there know what's going on in the world, but they feel like they're alone. They feel helpless, and they feel that it's hopeless because they don't realize that there are literally tens of thousands, if not millions, of people in the world who agree with them totally. Not much can be done one person alone. So we need lots of help. We've got to cooperate. And the effort, in my opinion, must be international for the reason I just mentioned a moment ago. Collectivism is global. And it used to be that I thought that, well, if we could just straighten up our own nation, straighten up our own house, everything will be fine. But I don't believe that anymore. This problem, we're facing forces that are organized across national boundaries. The collectivists we're facing are in every nation, and I think that in order for us to oppose them effectively, we have to do the same. Without giving up our sovereignty or without abandoning our principles of freedom, anything that we cherish in this country, we don't have to do any of those things. But we do need to cooperate with similar movements in other countries. I think the second thing is we need a core of dedicated people who are prepared to devote their lives to this battle. What we're facing now, Stan, is a need for far more than just writing your congressman now and then, far more than just signing a petition and expressing your point of view, far more than just writing a check and sending it into some political party of your choice, far more than subscribing to a magazine to get the latest information, far more of going to a patriotic dinner and having a good dinner and listen to a speaker tell you how bad things are. Now, that's the old way. The time for armchair patriotism is over. What we need is a dedicated core of people who are willing to literally devote a major portion of their lives to making a difference in the world. Our enemies do this. If we don't have a cadre of our own who are willing to do that, we cannot win. But fortunately, I know that there are many, many people out there who are waiting and anxious to do exactly that. The third thing we need is a training program to alert our members to the tactics used by the agents of collectivism, because they use very, very clever tactics, and if you don't understand what they're doing, you'll fall for them every time. Like, for example, the current peace demonstrations are a perfect example. What we have in the world today are two groups of collectivists, which I mentioned a moment ago, the Fabians on the one side and the Leninists on the other. They both want the same thing. They both want a world government based on the model of collectivism. But what they fight over is who is going to be dominant in that world government modeled after collectivism. The Leninists are the ones on the streets today organizing all of the peace demonstrations. They're appealing to people who are opposed to war, and, you know, I'm with them. I don't want any war. But we're being given a choice that is no choice at all. We're supposed to either side with the collectivists on one side or the Leninists on the other, and that's no choice at all. And the reason people are falling for that is because they do not understand the tactics used by our collectivist opponents. And so we need a training program to instruct them on what tactics are being used and how to ethically counter them. The fourth thing we need is the same support mechanisms that our foes have long enjoyed. That means we need coordination, strategy, training, communications, you know, schools, textbooks. Without these, we are doomed to failure. We have to know what we're doing. The fifth thing that we need is an organizational structure that cannot be subverted. Now, that's an interesting idea when you think about it. You know, the tendency is to form an organizational structure that is pyramidal in operation, where the top management is up there at the very tip, and then you've got middle management, and then all of the members at the bottom. This is the typical military structure. It's the typical corporate structure. And it's the instinctive thing to do. And all of the patriotic organizations that I can think of are formed in this manner. And in my opinion, that's the worst possible structure, because in that form, all our opponents have to do to defeat their opposition is to knock off the head of the organization. And that's not too difficult to do in this world. First thing, you can discredit the leadership. That's easy to do if you have influence in the mass media. You can paint anyone to look like an absolute demon. You can discredit the leadership. You can buy the leadership off. You can assassinate the leadership. You can marginalize the leadership. You can create internal schisms and fights within an organization to split the leadership. You could do all of these things, and if the organization is pyramidal in form, it will fall. So what we really need is what I call the holographic type of organization, and to my knowledge, this has never been done before. By the holographic form, I mean if you take a holographic plate that has an image impressed in it, and you pass the polarized light through it, and you see the image, it looks like it's sort of in the middle of the air somewhere. And yet if you take scissors and cut that plate in half and look at both halves, what you find is that the whole image is in both halves. Now, they're smaller, but the whole image is in both halves. And if you cut those in half again, and cut each quarter in half again, and then each eighth to a sixteenth, I don't care how small you go, each component of the whole holographic plate has the entire image impressed in it. And it's something I don't understand, but I know that that's how it works. And I got to thinking about that one day, and I said, that is the structure that we need for Freedom Force International. We want every smallest component in the organization, meaning every member, to have all of the information necessary to create an entire organization from the bottom up. All of the ideology, all of the rules, all of the strategies, everything is contained in the knowledge and in the papers of each individual member. So that if the time should come when, let's say, an extreme case, that every other member is knocked out of the picture, as long as there is one member left, he carries within his mind and in his papers the seed to regenerate the entire organization. You cannot destroy an organization like that, and certainly you diffuse the temptation for power too. There's another thing which we probably want to talk about in a moment when I said earlier that we have to reach for power. Well, power corrupts. We all know that. Lord Acton has said it so eloquently, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. So what is it that we think we are so smart? Why do we think that we can set up a structure so that if we are successful and we do acquire power in society, how are we going to make sure that we ourselves and those who follow us are not corrupted by that power? Well, I'd like to come back to that later if we have time. There are some definite ways, and I'm talking about one of them right now. The fact that there is a diffusion of power in the organizational structure so that there is no pyramid, that in itself is a strong measure to prevent the corruption of power from having an effect on our membership. So the organizational structure is very important. The sixth thing is that we need dependable funding, of course, to support the many services that are needed for the organizational activities. Our enemies have a lot of money. In fact, those in the banking circles, they make the bloody stuff. They make it out of nothing. Fortunately, I don't think we need anywhere near the amount of money that our opponents have, because they have to use it to overcome human nature. People want to be free, and they have to use it to subvert and to subject people. So they have to use money for bribery and blackmail. They have to fund assassination teams. They truly are on the dark side. And that takes a lot of money. It doesn't take an awful lot to convince people, on the other hand, that they want to be free and that they don't want any of that other kind of activity, then they want to dedicate their lives against it. You don't really have to buy people to do that. They want to do it. It's part of their instinct. And so, fortunately, we don't need the vast funding that our opponents do. But, of course, we do need adequate funding because that is a big job ahead. So that's number six. Number seven, and this is perhaps the most important of all, we need a clear statement of principles. What do we believe in? It's not enough to know what we are against. We must know what we are for. And I'll come back to that perhaps right after this and discuss the creed of freedom, which we have set before us. And finally, I think, Stan, the eighth thing is we need the long view of history. I think we need to realize that our mission may not be fulfilled in our lifetime. Now, that's kind of disappointing. But what we set in motion, I think, must be bigger than ourselves. And we must have momentum into the future. If it's the quick fix we're looking for, then I don't think a person with that view is going to feel comfortable in Freedom Force. We have to have the long view of history. So those are the eight points that I jotted down a couple of years ago. I said, these are the things we've got to have in order to turn this around. And then for the last few years, I've been trying to implement all of those 8 points, and I'm happy to say that they now are all in place and moving. This may be a good time to talk about the Creed of Freedom. Would you like to do that?
You go right ahead.
Well, okay, there's a little story behind that. What I just said a moment ago is something I have often said, which is that, you know, we need to have something we believe in, we have to know what we stand for, more important than what we're against, etc. And everybody said, yeah, you're right. And then it dawned on me one day, okay, who's going to write it? And I thought, uh-oh, I guess that's me. And I was really, well, you've never seen a worse case of writer's block in your life. Because, you know, I've spent all these years reading books and essays on freedom, and I've got a library full of these things, thousands of pages dealing with freedom issues, and I thought, how are you going to condense all of that into something preferably about one page or less, and yet that is so complete that it carries the essence of all of those pages of literature? And I thought, oh, it can't be done. And one of the reasons I was so frustrated is because I tried to write it as many people would do a political party platform. In other words, issues. You know, we stand for this and we're opposed to that. You know, we think that gun control is bad, and so issues. And finally it dawned on me, you know, issues are not going to do it. What we need are principles, broad principles. And once we get the principles in place, then all of the issues, the thousands of issues, can be determined simply by measuring them against the principles. And then one morning, and I can give you the exact date, because I've got it written down here, August 14 of 2002. Again, I sat up in bed. You probably think I do that a lot. Well, actually, I don't. But this was not one of those times. I sat up in bed, and I started to, well, I came out of a dream is what it was, and these words were rattling around in my brain. The proper function of government is to protect and not to provide. And I realized, oh, my gosh, it's the creed. It's trying to be born. So I jumped out of bed, I put on my robe and went down to my office, and I turned on the computer and I started to crank away. And believe it or not, by 2 o'clock in the afternoon, the creed was finished. It had taken me 40 years to write it, but only about a few hours on the computer. So here it is. I haven't had to change a word of it yet. I hope I don't. I think it's pretty complete. It's broken. Stan, is broken into five sections, and I'll just read the heading of the section, and then I'll read the text underneath it. The first one is headed "Intrinsic Nature of Rights." I believe that only individuals have rights, not the collective group; that these rights are intrinsic to each individual, not granted by the state. For if the state has the power to grant them, it also has the power to deny them, and that is incompatible with personal liberty. I believe that a just government derives its power solely from the governed. Therefore, the state must never presume to do anything beyond what the individual citizen also has the right to do. Otherwise, the state is a power unto itself and becomes the master instead of the servant of society. The second heading is supremacy of the individual. I believe that one of the greatest threats to freedom is to allow any group, no matter its numeric superiority, to deny the rights of the minority, and that one of the primary functions of just government is to protect each individual from the greed and passion of the majority. The third section is freedom of choice. I believe that desirable social and economic objectives are better achieved by voluntary action than by coercion of law. I believe that social tranquility and brotherhood are better achieved by tolerance, persuasion, and the power of good example than by coercion of law. I believe that those in need are better served by charity, which is the giving of one's own money, than by welfare, which is the giving of other people's money through coercion of law. The fourth section is called equality under law. I believe that all citizens should be equal under law, regardless of their national origin, race, religion, gender, education, economic status, lifestyle, or political opinion. Likewise, no class should be given preferential treatment regardless of the merit or popularity of its cause. To favor one class over another is not equality under law. And the fifth section is proper role of government. I believe that the proper role of government is negative, not positive, defensive, not aggressive. It is to protect, not to provide. For if the state is granted the power to provide for some, it must also be able to take from others. And once that power is granted, there are those who will seek it for their advantage. It always leads to legalized plunder and loss of freedom. If government is powerful enough to give us everything we want, it is also powerful enough to take from us everything we have. Therefore, the proper function of government is to protect the lives, liberty, and property of its citizens, nothing more. That government is best which governs least.
Ah, John Locke. Anyway, sounds very interesting. And so those are the five basic tenets?
Well, yeah, intrinsic nature of rights, supremacy of the individual, freedom of choice, equality under law, and proper role of government. And yes, Stan, you're quite right. You recognize John Locke in there. In fact, I've stolen liberally from just about every great thinker that I could think of.
Well, I don't feel bad. That's exactly what Thomas Jefferson did. He stole from Locke, and he stole from a Gladstone, a Blackstone. He stole from a Rutherford. He stole certainly liberally from many of the great Christian thinkers that had come before. And the ideas that he immortalized in the Declaration of Independence are basically the ideas of these people who had been struggling for the opportunity to have a nation under God with freedom for several hundred years.
Absolutely. So I, without embarrassment, admit that I have liberally lifted ideas from anywhere I could if I felt they had merit.
All right, fine. Now, of course, but where do these rights that we talk about come from? Because, certainly everybody wants to have rights, but where do our rights as an individual come from? Do they come from nature? Do they come from some ethereal place? Where does this right that the individual has to freedom originate?
Well, that, of course, you can get into debates, Stan, as to where they originate, which I would like to avoid. Most of us would say they come from God. But there are people who say, well, wait a minute, I'm not even sure about God, whether they come from God. But let's let's sidestep that issue and appeal to reason, if we can. You know, they either come with the individual at the time of birth, or they're added to the individual after birth. In other words, they're either hardware or software. And I think the average person, regardless of their theological beliefs, has to admit that if they're software, if they can be added after birth, that means that they come from the state. And as I said in the opening paragraph of the creed here, if the state has the power to grant rights, then it also has the power to deny them. And I don't think anybody wants to accept that ridiculous proposition. So regardless of their theological point of view, just their own self-interest must drive them to the correctness of the position that rights are hardwired. They come with the individual at the moment of birth, and they're not granted by the state.
All right, fine. So then you have your tenets of the rights of the individual. So where do we go from there?
Well, now that we have a creed of freedom that I hope everyone can sign on to if they've given, you know, much thought to these issues, and I think many people have, and I think this might have a chance of pulling together all of this vague thinking into one statement of principle. So far, at least, I'm happy to say that I have not yet run into anyone who says that they cannot accept this. But you know, Stan, I will. There are probably a lot of people out there that don't want to accept some of these provisions. But you know, most of them are going to be of the collectivist point of view. The collectivist, a true die-hard collectivist, will disagree with just about all of this. The collectivist is going to say that rights are granted by the state, that that's the only logical place for them to come from, and that the state should have control over individuals and determine who has rights and who doesn't have rights and to what extent they are. The collectivist will believe that the individual is not as important as the group. We say that, you know, that the individual is more important than the group, but the collectivist says, no, the greatest good for the greater number. The group is more important than the individual. And, of course, I would like to debate that point with anybody. The main argument being, well, wait a minute, what is group? Group, what is this group? Point to a group. You cannot point to a group. There's no such thing as a group. It's an abstraction. It's a word concept for many people. Just like the word forest. There's no such thing as a forest. It's an abstraction for the concept of many trees. So when you point to the forest, you're actually saying all those trees over there. And if you say, well, for the good of the forest, we're going to chop down a tree. You see what's happened. You've chopped down something of tangible value for an abstraction. Same thing in the group. If you sacrifice the individual for the greater good of the group, what you've done is really sacrifice an essence of the group itself. And the reason collectivists like that sophistry, because first of all, it sounds very appealing at first. It's hard to, you know, at first blush, you think, oh, it sounds reasonable. The group, you know, greater good for the greater number. They like that because somebody ultimately has to be in the position of deciding what is the greater good for the greater number. And, of course, they're the first ones to apply for the job. That gives them the political power to be in the driver's seat, so to speak, and to control society and alter society and make these decisions always in the name of the group. But when you come right down to it, it's really in the name of some individuals over the advantage of other individuals.
All right. Well, we're going to have to, of course, bid adieu to our listeners up in the Great Northwest, and then we'll get back here. And if you in the Great Northwest listening and would like the second hour of the program, you can always call us at 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. But our guest has been Edward Griffin, and of course he has been developing an idea that he's been working with for many years called Freedom Force, and trying to say how people really should begin to look at the world and what can be done to counter the collectivists and these people of great wealth and power who have seized control of the reins of government, have compromised and undermined the very fabric of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, and are moving us rapidly away from freedom towards fascism. Ed, how can people get in touch with you if they would like to?
Well, I think for this issue that we're talking about tonight, the best way is to come onto our website. And that's www.freedom-force.org.
And, all right, fine.
And then my name will be splattered all over the place, and there'll be links where they can send me emails. And but if they come onto the website, Stan, they'll be able to see many of the issues that I've been talking about are explained in greater detail. There's an explanation, for example, about our symbol, which is kind of like an upside-down peace symbol, and there's kind of an interesting story behind that.
All right, well, we're going to then you can go to www.freedomforce.org.
It's freedom-force.
Freedom-force.org. Right. And we're going to be back with Ed in just a few minutes. I just have to remind our listeners, the Great Northwest, that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported. If you believe we have interesting subjects discussed here, why, of course, would hope that many of you would want to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters. If you would like to know what is really happening and understand the recent war with Iraq, we have a great new syllabus. It's called Iraq, the Untold Story, Prelude to World War III. We have a video by the that title, which we'll have copies of here, hopefully, within a week. That's Iraq, the Untold Story, Prelude to World War III. And then, of course, if you'd like to get a copy of our March newsletter, which explains that the fact that this war, and not simply the Afghan and the Iraqi war, but certainly the coming war with Syria and the other wars we're about to enter into, were planned long ahead of time. Why, you can give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. Ask for our March newsletter, and it'll give you the documentation, not from what I say, but from what they say. You can go to our website at radioliberty.com, pull down our newsletters, our programs, or you can go to their website, which is the newamericancentury.org, www.newamericancentury.org. Read their plan for rebuilding America's defenses, where they talk about how we're not going to have this unless there's a catastrophic and catalytic event like another Pearl Harbor and other similar interesting observations. And, of course, how we're going to be able to create new diseases that'll target people genetically. In other words, we can do away with certain races of people. That's page 60 or 61. Well, give us a call, pardon me, and get a copy of my newsletter, 1-800-5-HIV. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. We welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And so we are sort of laying out the background behind Ed's vision of Freedom Force And, of course, if you want to give us a call, why? Ed, are you willing to take calls, or would you rather wait for a while?
Oh, no, if called would be fine.
All right, fine. So if you have a question or comment, why, you can give us a call. But I'm just going to let Ed pick up the ball and run with it. But if there's something you'd like to raise, a question or comment, why, of course, you know our number. It's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California, 464-8295. Go ahead, Ed.
Well, thanks, Dan. I don't know whether I'm holding the interest of your listeners or not. These topics are intensely interesting to me. And as I mentioned earlier, we had a seminar Sunday that went on for 6 hours, and we even had to cut that short. So, you know, there's a lot that needs to be covered. One of the things I mentioned before that may be of interest to your leaders is the statement that I made about attending a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and discovering that, you know, they had rules that were always read at the meetings, and I felt that was one of the missing links for any program that we wanted to institute, so that the future generations would constantly be reminded of some of the guiding founding principles that we're concerned about today. So I've come up with, actually there are 11 rules in what we call the Code of Conduct. I'd like to mention just a few of them, six of them actually. All of them, by the way, can be read on our website. And I urge anybody that is interested in this to come onto our website, which is www.freedom-force.org. And here's one of the things they're going to find there, the Code of Conduct. And the first rule is this. It says, the first order is, don't wait for orders. Freedom Force is not pyramidal, but holographic in structure. I mentioned that before. That's a very important concept. Therefore, instead of waiting for instructions from a monolithic directorate, become self-directed. Join with others when that is advantageous, but also don't be afraid to duplicate and parallel their efforts. Experiment. Make mistakes. Find a better way. As long as your activities are within the confines of the creed of freedom and the bylaws, the effort will be constructive. What may seem like chaos at first actually is the ferment of creativity and competition. It will ultimately far surpass the output of bureaucratic and dogmatic control from the top, and it will allow the movement to spread rapidly into virtually any culture and any part of the world. The second one reads, disobey any directive from Freedom Force that, in your opinion, violates the creed of freedom or the spirit of this code of conduct. All actions must be consistent with personal conviction and conscience. The third one is, don't trust your leaders. That applies to Freedom Force as well as in politics. Don't expect them to be saints. Most of them are corruptible under the right circumstances. Your job is to watch them like a hawk. Don't let them get away with anything that violates the creed or this code of conduct. Become familiar with the organizational bylaws and make sure your leaders adhere to them in both letter and spirit. Call attention to their misdeeds and mobilize the power to remove them for serious violations. We'll skip to the eighth one. Live by your principles without compromise. Popular approval is not your primary concern. You are a warrior. Accept the risks and the consequences. Stand tall in your convictions. Be an example for others. The ninth one reads, show tolerance, compassion, and goodwill toward all. Extend a welcome to members of all races, nationalities, religions, and cultures, provided only that they honor the creed of freedom. Expect diversity, knowing that in spite of differences, our common mission binds us to a genuine global brotherhood. And the 11th one is, this relates to our conversation earlier, says, the final rule is read the rules. At every meeting attended by 20 members or more, read aloud the Creed of Freedom and this Code of Conduct. The principles contained in these statements are of no consequence if they are forgotten. Reading them aloud in this manner will always keep them in the center of our deliberations. This recitation is the autopilot that will keep us and those who follow on the right course forever. Now, you see what we're trying to do there, Stan? We're trying to set in motion certain principles that everybody can follow, not only now but in the future, and they don't have to, you know, constantly be directed from above. So I don't know if that makes sense to you and your listeners, but that's what we're trying to do.
All right, fine. So then, of course, how are you going to spread these ideas? And of course, what are people going to do to be effective in this battle for the preservation of freedom?
Okay. Well, I'm sorry, I missed your question. Well, somebody just walked in the room there. What was that again?
I'm saying basically, how are people going to be effective in this battle? What are they going to do? How are they going to be effective in this battle for the preservation of individual freedom?
The thing that we're asking everyone to do after they become familiar with our organization and what our creed is and our, you know, our goals, is we're asking them to become effective in organizational work. You know, the typical conservative has always said, "Oh well, organizational work is not interesting. It's a bunch of backbiting and politics. Oh, politics is dirty. I don't want anything to do with that." And so the typical conservative backs away from the real battlefield. See, this is where the battle is, and we leave it to our collectivist opponents because we simply aren't there to engage them in battle. So what we're asking our people to do, Stan, is to pick out an organization or several of them that sort of crossed their lives in some personal or professional way. It might be a professional organization. It might be a private organization. It might be a lawyer's guild. It might be a Rotary Club, it might be a political party, it might be a labor union, or who knows what it is, and go into those organizations and support them and become active in them and become influential in them. This is time-consuming. We're asking them not to do it alone, but to find others of similar mind to work with them in it. Eventually, the goal is to become influential and dominant in those organizations, just like our collectivist opponents have. And that really is the simple agenda of the whole organization.
But in the final analysis, the power really is in government, and that is where the legal power is. And, of course, the other side has phenomenal amounts of money to buy the leaders of the Republican Party, to buy the leaders of the Democrat Party, to buy the politicians, or to provide them with the funds to get elected, and then, of course, to reward them as long as they go along with their agenda, and to destroy them if they don't. And this is the problem that we face today. Once we accept that we are a democracy and that our elected leaders can do whatever they want to as long as they have a majority, then we've lost the very essence of our Republican nation of laws, of where the elected representatives are limited by the chains of the Constitution.
Well, as I say, I think the only way to prevent that is to, I'm agreeing with you that we have to have political influence. And the only way to do that is to become active in political parties. It doesn't mean any one particular political party, but all political parties. Our collectivist opponents are dominant in all of the major political parties, both Republicans and Democrats. And to some extent, I'm horrified to say, even in the other parties that offer themselves as constructive opposition. They tend to get people divided on issues, but they never talk about principles. The ones that we've been talking about here tonight, you never hear discussed on a political party platform. So back to your question, I think the answer is for our people to go into these organizations. Certainly the political parties are one of those most important organizations, but the political parties themselves feed off of support or opposition from other organizations as well. So I think that's the answer, and we're not trying to coordinate a master plan that will tell everybody exactly what to do. I think if we get enough people out there splashing around in the right direction, they'll figure it out for themselves.
All right, and then, of course, then what will we do about the actual political control, running candidates for office?
Well, that comes, I think, as a result of being active and influential in the political parties. Let's say that you and I and a bunch of our friends were very influential in the local political group that we're affiliated with, and that same condition happened all around the country. By the time there was a national nominating convention, it would no longer be possible to steamroller everybody into accepting a candidate selected by the Council on Foreign Relations Group. all of these little groups from around the country would stand up against that and say, no, we're not going for that. We have our own candidate. So, yes, it's not very dramatic. It's not like saying, well, if we can just get a president elected, that sounds very nice and it's very easy. Just get the president elected. But the president, is just one man. If he doesn't have a vast support from the community, if he doesn't have support of all of the organizations, he can't do anything.
All right, we've got Jeannie calling in from Silver Beach, and incidentally, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Jeannie, why don't you tell us what you're thinking?
Well, we have a problem here in La Selva Beach, California, and this is what's happening throughout all of the United States. The La Selva Beach Improvement Association, they are changing their bylaws, and they want to become a 501c3 nonprofit organization. And they're telling the members that it's for tax purposes. And we have just looked at their draft bylaws, and it's something like a Soviet council would have done, or a council in Hitler's Germany. They always mention community. For instance, they say monitor outside activities that impact or affect the interests of our community. Everything is for the well-being of the community. And there is hardcore Marxists here in La Selva Beach organizing this Home Improvement Association. So how do we remedy this situation? Because when we try to, the average person that tries to these bylaws to get private property protected, they don't listen to us and they just do what they're going to do. So what you're saying, Mr. Griffin, sounds great. But they're forming all these Soviet councils throughout the United States.
The local community improvement associations,
right,
groups, the Agenda 21 sort of groups that they're setting up all across America. So let's get down to where the rubber meets the road, Ed. How do we counter the other side unless we have people who know there's a problem, who understand the problem, and are willing to commit themselves the whole of their lives as the people on the other side do? Because the one thing I will say about the Marxists is they believe and they're willing to give all of their time and effort and money in this this battle. And the trouble is with most of our people, as you said, they're infected with apathy. They
right.
don't value freedom. They don't know there's a problem. And you tell them there's a problem, they don't want to hear about it because they want to enjoy their life. But they're not committed like the people on the other side. So here's Jeannie and a couple of people out there, and the rest of the hardcore Marxists are manipulating all the good people in the community, and they don't even realize they're being manipulated.
Right.
They don't understand what the issues are.
Right. Well, I've got a couple of thoughts that come to mind on all of this. First of all, as you were describing the proposal that was being made there, this is classic collectivism, the community, the group, always the group, and they never think about the individual. The individual has to be sacrificed, if necessary, for the greater good of the group, or the greater good, in this case, of the community. That's a dead giveaway of collectivist thinking, and you're quite right to recognize that it's probably a bunch of Marxists behind it, or probably it could be Fabians as well. I mean, they're anti-Marxist, but they're not anti-collectivist. But now the issue, though, is what do you do about it? And that's where I am. I'm so clear in my thinking. You cannot do anything about it unless you have the power. And as long as we are standing out there saying, oh, isn't this terrible? Oh, what are we going to do about it? They're just doing this regardless of what we say. We petition them, and we ask them, we plead with them, we write letters, and they don't listen to us. That's because they have the power, and we don't, you see. It's a classic case of what I'm talking about. We have to get in there. We have kind of a little motto here that I kind of like. Here's the motto. Don't fight City Hall. Become City Hall. That's our problem. We've never had the vision of becoming City Hall. You and your friends have got to get together and form a little nucleus. I hope it would be the Freedom Force group. Form a chapter, get 6, 7, 8, 20, 30 people who all agree. Go into these organizations. Join them. Move into them. Or set up counter organizations that will have an equal voice, an equal force. And just take this ball away from them. But you can't do it alone. You have to be cooperating with others of like mind, and you have to have a vision of where you're headed. It's not just enough to know what you're against. So you're against this proposal. That's not good enough. What's going to bind you together after this proposal is beaten? Well, they'll be back next year with another proposal like it, and you'll have to come back and fight them again. No, we have to have positive goals of our own and agendas of our own, not only just to defeat their proposals, but to push back some of the ones that they got in place last year and the year before. And so that's why I'm suggesting that it's important for people to get together and form chapters of Freedom Force and then go into organizations or create organizations to do the opposite of what this little community group is doing that you're telling me about.
You know, Genia, one of the things that I learned when I was in the California Medical Association, and I've got 450 doctors there. Most of them are good-hearted people. There are a few hardcore Marxists and communists there, and most of them gravitated into positions of leadership, or certainly people of the fascist mentality, doesn't really matter. But how was I going to swing them around to my point of view on the AIDS epidemic? Why, I would write them letters. I would write them at my expense and mail those letters out, three times a year. On various issues, and always before there was going to be a major meeting, so that, you know, they would understand what the issues were. And gradually, little by little, year after year, I was gradually able to win the majority of the doctors in the California Medical Association to my position that we needed to take the proper approach to the AIDS epidemic and treat it like an infectious disease rather than a civil rights issue. Now, it's so much easier to do this now with the ability to send faxes, the ability to get emails. What you need, of course, is the membership list of the members of this organization, so you can begin to try to win them around to your position rather than their position. And of course, the thing is that most people do value freedom and do value property, and they don't understand how they're being manipulated. And of course, it has to be, you have to be a little careful in how you write your letters without attacking the other side. You stand on principles and what this is and where this is going to lead. And if you want your private property, you're going to have to back those of us who believe in individual freedom and private property, not those who are concerned about the community. Because, of course, when you're concerned about the community, the community supersedes property rights, and property rights are the foundation of all freedom.
And there is no such thing as community anyway.
Right.
What's interesting, to be a member of La Selva Beach Improvement Association, it's only the main drag here in La Selva Beach. They will not accept members, say farmers and ranchers, that are in the rural area. And so that, I feel, is discrimination. They want their core group in the town proper itself to be able to control the organization.
But that's what it's always all about.
Sure. Always control.
You have to figure out how you're going to reach the good people and get them on your side. That's what you've got to do. And you're going to have to do it with emails. You're going to have to do it with faxes. But it's a lot cheaper than doing a mailing every time on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. But you have to be careful how you approach it as well, so that you don't antagonize them, but you simply stick with the facts. And, of course, always undermine your arguments with this request, whole concept of individual freedom.
Right. Well, they're very dedicated, the Fabians and the Marxists, extremely dedicated. And I often think, everyone is working just to put a roof over their head and to eat, and the progressive taxes going up. And so they're exhausted when the average person comes home. They don't have time sometimes to go to the meetings and find out what's happening. But I'll tell you, these collectivists are very, very dedicated. And what I will do, I will log on to Mr. Griffin's website. I have that already.
All right, fine. Anything else, Jeannie?
No, that's it.
Thank you so
much. Well, thank you, Jeannie. I'll be looking forward to talking to you.
Okay.
Okay, and let's go to Nathan calling from Contra Costa. And again, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here on the Central Coast of California, 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Go ahead, Nathan.
Well, hey, good evening to both of you. It's a pleasure to talk to both of you. Sir, to your guest, Griff, I have heard of you. Your name has preceded you, sir.
That could be good or bad, I suppose.
He wrote the book, The Creature from Jekyll Island.
Yes.
Wrote a wonderful book on the United Nations many years ago. The title was taken from that quotation from George Washington, having to do with a fearful master. Certainly, government is not force; it's not eloquence. It is a fearful master. Basically, that was the title, The Fearful Master. Really, the first great book we had on the United Nations.
Well, thank you. Well, listen, I would like your response to this, sir, and I would most value your opinion. That there's two levels we have to look at getting back to our constitutional and common law foundation. One is obviously God's laws and the, you know, universal principles of monotheism and all the rest of it, and that's obviously important, and we need to focus on that. But on a secular basis, you are, of course, familiar with the fact that in our constitution, we don't really have the tradition that a simple majority vote passes the law. It's not written down. That's a tradition that we've inherited, but they could easily make it pass a resolution tomorrow and make it two-thirds. That means they would have to get a supermajority to pass new laws or new restrictions on our freedom. Do you believe that this would be a realistic thing to push for, to rein in the power of government and the power to infringe on our lives?
I don't think it would be realistic, Nathan, because those characters that are in there now who would be voting on this measure wouldn't want it. I mean, they are firm believers in democracy in the worst sense of the word. They don't want limitations on their power. They might give you lip service and say, yeah, that's a good idea, but when push comes to shove, they wouldn't support it. Or if they did, they'd say they'd put enough exceptions in there that anytime they wanted to violate the rule, they could. And beyond that, I'm not so sure that that requiring a two-thirds vote on most issues is necessarily a good idea. I think it depends on what the issues are. If the Constitution were clearly adhered to in the spirit in which it was written, there would be no issue coming before Congress that could be that dangerous in the first place.
Unfortunately, though, sir, that's not the world in which we live.
That's not the world in which we live, yeah. So I'm saying trying to fix one problem by trying to mend one branch by fixing another branch, I don't think is going to work. I think our problem is that the people in Congress are collectivists. And until we change that, none of these patches are going to work. Fixing up the mechanism won't fix it unless we change the gasoline, so to speak. In other words, we got to get new people in there with new ideals and new principles. And once we do that, then we don't need to worry about two-thirds vote or 51% vote. Oh, it'll take care of itself. Now, I'm not against the idea, you understand. I'm just saying, you asked me if it was, I thought, a practical approach, and I don't think it would work any more than the idea of setting a limit on the national debt worked. Everybody thought, okay, we'll get our congressman to put a limit on the national debt. And so that was a big political issue there for a while, and they voted. They put a limit on the national debt. Ah, big victory. Until they wanted to change the limit, and then they voted to remove the limit.
Or the balanced budget amendment.
Yeah, balanced budget amendment. And those things mean nothing as long as the mentality of the people in Congress is what it is. So we have to focus on changing that. That's my opinion.
Okay, anything else, Nathan?
Well, thank you very much.
Okay, fine. Well, that was Nathan calling from Contra Costa. And everybody's looking for an easy fix, and the trouble is that there is no such thing as an easy fix. You know, Freedom is something that demands a total dedication on the part of the people. And when there are more people who are dedicated to the destruction of freedom than there are to those dedicated to its preservation, then freedom will be lost. And I'll never forget, there was a man named Louis Bedens. And Louis Bedens was the editor for a time of the Worker, the communist publication. He wrote a book called The Whole of Their Lives. And he was talking about the communists and how they were willing to give everything they had financially, time-wise, to this goal of trying to make a better world. And an awful lot of communists who really believed in communism, they saw the problems inherent in our society, and they thought if we could only destroy it and bring in this utopian society, never, of course, realizing that there never was any communism in Russia. It was always a power structure. Misnomer of what's going on in the Soviet Union, or the whole idea that Russia was a communist nation, most ridiculous idea in the world. It was a power structure with a massive military and police force and Gestapo, and then everybody else enslaved.
Right, it was a collectivist system.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah, Louis Boudin's book was really strong. I think he said something like, we communists... To us, communism is our lives, our food, our drink, our sleep, our lovers. We devote their all. They said we devote our all to this mission.
The whole of our lives.
The whole of our lives, yeah. And, you know, that is the kind of passion that we need for freedom. Those are the kinds of people I'm looking for, Stan, the ones who will live and breathe and sleep freedom. And are not just armchair patriots who will send in a donation now and then and say, okay, you guys are doing a good job. Let me know how it's coming out every once in a while. No, we need real dedicated people.
All right, fine. Well, I think that now you're... How long has this Freedom Force actually been in effect? How long have you actually had the organization going?
We got our first members almost accidentally on December 12, 2002. I happened to be at an offshore seminar in the Dominican Republic speaking on the Federal Reserve System. And they had a pretty good crowd there, and afterwards I let it be known that if anybody was interested, I'd like to talk to them about an organization I had in mind called Freedom Force International. So I invited them to an evening presentation. Well, about 60 people showed up, which I was kind of surprised to see. And when we finished the meeting, we had about 30 members. So we had members from Australia and New Zealand and Canada and the United States at our very first meeting, which was held in the Dominican Republic, which is not typical, of course, but it did dramatize the fact that we are an international movement, which I think is a very important concept here. Nothing really happened after that until our last meeting Sunday, Stan. Because I had to get all of our accounting together. When you accept members, you have to, you know, handle them. You have to set up records. You have to protect those records so they can't be compromised on the internet. You have to have an accounting system, a checking account, you know, and all that stuff. And that has taken me several months. But now that's all in place. And we had our first meeting last Sunday, and I'm really happy to report that the membership is coming in very strong right now. So I guess what I'm really saying is that we are now officially up and running.
All right, fine. Well, I heard about that meeting you were going to be put on at Tom's home there, and I hope I know there was a lot of enthusiasm for it. So I'm certainly appreciative of what you're doing. We'll be back here in just a moment or two, and we'll welcome your calls from across America, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. And the question is, are there enough people who really value freedom who are willing to get in and give the whole of their lives to preserve this for generations yet unborn? And yet, of course, what people don't understand is that life without freedom is life without meaning. We'll be back here in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course our guest this evening is Ed Griffin, and we're going to be talking about his concept of Freedom Force, putting together a decentralized organization that will have every individual dedicated to this idea of preserving freedom. Now, what part does the Constitution play in this vision you have of the new organization?
Stan, I look at the Constitution of the United States as a great teaching tool and a great, what shall I say, it's a milestone on the way to the development of a future system which is even better than we enjoyed in the early stages of the American Republic. The Constitution, I think, for a first attempt, was an amazingly wonderful document. It didn't quite make it. It was not strong enough to survive the attacks against it. As we all know today, the Constitution, although it's still there, nobody pays any attention to it. Our leaders ignore it. Everybody thinks it's an antiquated document. They don't think it's relevant. It does not control our government today. Regardless of what we may think about its value, it is dead today. And that is a very unpleasant fact for some of us old-timers to face. So the question is, well, can we revive it? I hope so. But even beyond reviving it, can we improve it when we do? And that's where my focus is. Not just to revive and get back to where we were, but let's move forward. Let's make it better. Let's find out why the Constitution was it was able to be subverted. What were the weaknesses? What can we do next time around, and I think there's got to be a next time around, that the future generations can say, well, we've got a better document now. And that's really what Freedom Force is all about, is to move forward, not just to go back to where we were, but to go forward to a higher level than we never even achieved before.
Well, now, why do you think that the Constitution was subversive, and who subverted it, and was there an organized effort to change our Constitution, and of course to take God and prayer out of our schools, to find within the Constitution the right of a woman to have an abortion? Was there a conscious, organized effort on somebody's part to subvert the Constitution and allow the centralization of power with government? And if there was a conscious, organized effort, who was behind that? And was there more to it than most people know?
Well, there were a couple of questions there. How did it happen? First of all, I think we're in agreement it did happen. And the second question is, well, how did it happen? And it happened primarily, I think, through Supreme Court interpretations of the Constitution and also through apathy on the part of the American people who didn't really care much about the Constitution. Ignorance. The older folks who knew about the value of the Constitution have died off, and the younger generation has come up through a school system that didn't teach the value of these principles, so they don't know about it. So it's gradually just withered away in the hearts and the minds of the American people. It's been attacked from all sides, and that leads to the next question, well, who did it? Was it an organized effort? I think it was partly organized and partly just spontaneous, but who? That's easy to answer. The collectivists. There are all kinds of collectivists out there, all different colors, all different brands. I break them down into two basic groups, as you know, the Leninists and the Fabians. And both of those groups have been actively attacking our Constitution, and both for the same reasons. They do not like limitations on government. Their goal, the goal of all collectivists, is powerful, centralized government. The ultimate goal is world government based on the collectivist model. And both the Fabians and the Marxists have the same goal, and therefore they have the same objective of subverting our Constitution and moving the United States in that direction so that it can be comfortably merged into a world government based on the collectivist model.
Well, then where did the Council on Foreign Relations, the Bilderbergers, the Trilateral Commission, the Club of Rome, and say the Masons fit into this concept that you've laid out of Marxists, or I should say of Fabians and Leninists?
Well, I would say, I don't know about the Masons, but all the other groups that you've mentioned, in my mind, clearly are in the Fabian camp. Now, when I say the Fabian camp, I don't mean that they are members of the Fabian society, because most of them are not. I mean, on the world stage, Tony Blair is a member of the Fabian Society, but most of the people on this side of the ocean are not. But the reason I call them Fabians is not because they're members, but because they embrace the Fabian ideology and the Fabian strategy. They are collectivists, and they believe in coming to power from the inside, gradually, without force and violence, preferably, using the structures of parliamentary government to come to power. That's Fabianism, and all of these guys are using that same principle. And, of course, they cooperate with each other on their common goals, and yet they compete with each other for dominance within the structure. That's why we see forces out there that appear to be opposites. They're fighting each other. Sometimes they even get into wars with each other, and we think, golly, those guys are opposites. But no, they're just struggling for dominance within the collectivist world government structure that they're trying to build.
All right, let's go to Tony, who's calling here, and he has a question and a comment. Hi, Tony. How are you doing?
Oh, fairly well. Hi. Yeah, I really enjoyed Mr. Griffin's book. I read it several years ago. I think it's kind of a watershed on the Federal Reserve.
Thank you.
My question actually had to do with that. Since you're probably more up on current events on the Federal Reserve, has there been any kind of progress in, as far as returning towards a constitutional monetary system and getting rid of the Fed or having it audited or anything like that?
No, there's nothing significant. Of course, Congressman Ron Paul always puts in a resolution for the repeal of the Federal Reserve System, and he gets each time he gets a few more people to support it. But it's a long way from being a powerful political movement. However, I think I'm accurate in saying this, that there is a groundswell of popular opinion growing out there that one of these days is going to break through the surface, and it's going to become politically advantageous for a lot of fence-sitting politicians to suddenly jump on that issue. I think that the demand for repeal of the Fed is much stronger than it appears, by just seeing what's going on in Congress. I don't know what it's going to take to make that breakthrough. Probably as long as the volatile issue of the war is going on, that might, be pushed into a second place, which is maybe one of the reasons for the war, not the main one, but one of them. But I do think that the American people are getting revved up for some drastic changes in that. I don't think that an audit of the Fed is a significant step. I think that may be pushed forward as an excuse to let people think that their congressman is really taking a strong stand. Congressman so-and-so says, I call for an audit of the Federal Reserve System. And it makes it sound as though he's really opposing the Fed. Well, an audit is not opposition to the Fed. If they audit the Fed, I'm sure that what they'll find is that nothing unusual has taken place, that they're doing exactly what they said they're doing. They're creating money out of nothing, and they're just obeying the rules. So an audit, I think, is a big waste of time. We don't need to audit the Fed. We need to abolish it. But nevertheless, your basic question, I think, is there anything happening on the national scene in that direction? And I think there is, but it's not yet visible in Congress.
Well, now, there was a lawsuit, one of the old-time newsletter writers had actually brought a lawsuit against the Federal Reserve System and certain of the central banks for manipulating the gold price. I'm sure you're well acquainted of what
yes.
I'm speaking of. Blanchard, I believe it was.
Yeah, there's a gold committee there that's got the smoking gun on the fact that the Federal Reserve and others unnamed have been controlling the price of gold.
And, of course, that's illegal, but as long as they control the courts and they control, the Justice Department, why, it's pretty hard to bring a lawsuit against them, and yet, of course, a lawsuit has to be brought. These people have violated the laws consistently, because if they can control the price of gold, then, of course, we have no other alternative other than to use their phony, baloney, fiat money as a means of exchange in our society. And so they've created the problem, and they provided the solution. You use the money that we create out of nothing.
Right. And I think someday that'll all become common knowledge, and they'll say, well, yes, but we did it for the greater good of the greater number. We did it for society. We did it for the group. We're back to the collectivist mentality again, you see. That permeates all of these things. If they can just say that they did it for you folks, then it makes it okay. They can violate any law if they can claim a worthy reason for doing it. That's what FDR claimed when he sacrificed American servicemen at Pearl Harbor. well, it was a terrible thing, terrible loss of lives, but in the long run, it was better for America. It was good for you folks, after all.
Anything else there, Tony?
Well, since you mentioned the Blanchard lawsuit, I followed that a little bit. In fact, I've written several congressmen, including Ron Paul, about it. One of the things that I sort of chided them about was that the Constitution, not that it's pertinent anymore since the Emergency War Powers Act, which they refused to do anything about, but the Constitution says that Congress is supposed to regulate the value of our currency. And now we're letting Barrick Gold do it by allowing them to control, to lease what they call lease. They do leasing of gold from the central banks, and then they dump it on the market. They push the price down. Then they're able to take that money and then invest it, and then pay that back later to the central banks at some other date. And you know, basically now, instead of Congress controlling the value of quote currency, we let a Canadian mining company do it.
Right.
So.
Is there a point you want to make, Tony?
Well, I don't know what the point is about it. It's just all kind of silly.
But when you
said something earlier about Mr. Griffin said about how we can improve on the Constitution, I've thought about that before, and I think there was only one thing that the framers left out that should be any different than what was, you know, the Constitution and the first ten amendments, and that was that if any congressman were to sponsor any bill that was in contradiction to the Constitution, that there be a sergeant of arms on duty at all times, and that the sergeant of arms takes that member out and has him shot.
All right, well, I'll second
that. Would be
that.
A short-form amendment.
Right.
Well, I don't think that they would have been proposing legislation that was blatantly unconstitutional.
Well, Tony, for many years, people understood that, and of course, the Congress didn't meet more than just a few weeks out of the year, and of course, because there was only a certain limited amount that they could do, and that is really still true in many of our state legislatures. Many of the state legislatures only meet every other year, and not only for a short period of time, because they recognize the Will Rogers said, no man's purse or property are safe when the legislature is in session. So, there's nothing that the government can ordinarily do other than to take our money and come up with new oppressive types of regulation. So what we need to do is understand that government is the enemy of freedom. And liberty and limited government are synonymous. We need government to protect us from foreign enemies. Wouldn't it be nice if we had a military that was protecting America and protecting our borders instead of pursuing an internationalist aggressive agenda throughout the rest of the world?
Well, what I've been coming aware of the last 2 years or so is that, yes, indeed, that would be true. But unfortunately, I think that the opposite is true.
Yeah,
and unfortunately, I believe... And I've got reasons for believing it. I mean, that House Resolution 2977 right now that was just turned into House Resolution 3616 from the congressman from Ohio that is seeking to ban space-based weapons, including chemtrails. You read that thing and you realize that these congressmen know exactly what's going on, and, you know, yet they deny everything. But yet then it appears to me, decided that the American people are the enemy now. And it seems like they're acting upon it. And I know that's really hard to believe and everything, but like when you look up, like last Thursday, I mean, I couldn't even work all day. I mean, that spray was coming down all over the place. It was sticky. I mean, it was everywhere. It was just like... why are they doing this? And
the answer is not
a very good one.
That's a program.
I know that's another program.
Okay. Thanks so much, Tony.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
Stan, I'd like to sort of comment on the tail end of that. I don't think that these politicians think of the American people as the enemy. I think they are collectivists, which means they think of the people as being their wards, and they must take care of them. and that means they must lie to them for their own good. They really think of themselves as being benevolent. That's part of the collectivist mentality. And they think that they have an obligation to rule for the benefit of mankind, and that means that the people must not be informed and must be fooled for their own good.
Well, we've certainly seen an excellent example of that in this recent weeks, as we, of course, we've gone to war with Iraq. Well, they did not tell the American people that they've always intended to go against Syria and against Lebanon and against Iran, but you can't tell them. We've got to tell them it's about weapons of mass destruction.
It's not for their own good, you see.
Because it didn't matter that they knew that Saddam's weapons of mass destruction had been moved over into Syria. They'd known that for a long period of time, and that fact was confirmed during a recent interview with Ambassador Dor Gold, the former Israeli ambassador to the United Nations, when I brought that subject up with him about the Saddam's weapons being over in Syria. He agreed, everybody knows about it, except the American people.
Yeah.
And the American people honestly believe that we went to war with Saddam Hussein because we knew he had weapons of mass destruction.
Yeah. Well, they have to be told that to keep them content. It's for their own good. That's the collectivist viewpoint. They have another agenda over there, which is they believe in the best interests of the world, or at least of the American people, for the Americans to be dominant throughout that region. You mentioned the paper earlier. They spelled it right out. They want a Pax Americana.
Right.
And that, they say, is in the best interest of the American people. So therefore, they have to lie to the American people, otherwise they might not understand.
If they didn't lie, the American people might understand.
Or they might understand.
Rise up in their righteous indignation and say, no way, Jose.
Right. Well, that's because they don't respect the opinion of the American people. They think they're too uninformed, too ignorant, and unfortunately in some cases that's true. But the remedy is not to lie to them, but the remedy is just to be outspoken and tell the truth.
Amen. Well, that's one nice thing about having at least some voice on radio. We do have an opportunity to reach people across America with the news they're not going to get elsewhere. So if you're out there in the listening audience, we have time for another couple of questions for Ed Griffin, who is the organizer of Freedom Force, which is a new would you call it a conservative patriotic organization?
No, I definitely would not.
Well, how do you refer to your organization?
I want to see people lose all of those words about conservatives, liberals, left-wing, right-wing, communists, fascists, socialists. Those words mean nothing. There are only two issues out here anymore, and that's collectivism versus individualism, freedom versus totalitarianism. Those are the only words we want to use. And so to describe us, we are an organization promoting the concepts of individualism.
And freedom.
And freedom. That comes from individualism, yes.
Right.
Freedom, individualism, right. But I would definitely not say conservative, because everybody and their uncle who thinks they're a conservative, they've all got different views of what that means. And as we all know, some of our so-called conservative leaders are quite collectivist in their thinking.
All right, fine. So is there any spiritual component to your movement as such?
Well, you know, I think that there is. One of the things I had to grapple with, Stan, is how deeply do we want to get into that? How deeply should we get into that? I feel personally that that's an important component of any struggle for freedom. But my experience over the 40 years or so has been that theology often becomes a point of division among people who are fighting for their freedoms. And what we want to do is not to downplay or to ignore theology, because it's an important part of our lives. It's an important part of this movement. But we want to focus on the fact that the one thing that's common to all of the great religions of the world is that they're based on the assumption that man must have a free will to choose. Freedom is, in a way, the underlying principle of all religious doctrine. If you don't have freedom, it's pretty hard to have a religious experience, let's say, unless you're willing to accept it in the cell of a concentration camp, which I don't think most people have in mind as the ideal. And so what we want people to do in Freedom Force is to bring their own cherished religious views with them, but not to ridicule others who may have a different point of view, and not to expect everyone to conform and have the same theology. it's a very delicate line we want to travel, but I think it's going to be possible, and I think it's essential that we do so.
All right, fine. Well, now, of course, would what you're doing appeal to any of the people who we might today call liberals?
Oh, I think a lot of people that we call liberals are individualists. Once they understand the issues that we're talking about, they're not going to go for all this collectivist stuff. And, you know, most of us, I guess, maybe all of us, for all I know, once started out on this political journey from a position of where we considered ourselves once to be liberals. I did. And most of the people I've talked to now are, you know, agreeing with what I'm saying, look back and kind of laugh and say, yeah, when I came out of school, I was a liberal, man. I believed in all of these ideas. And, of course, a liberal in that sense is a person with a big heart, somebody who wants to see other people do well, one who you know, has a charitable instinct and all those things. But where people disagree is not over objectives but on methods. And what really divides the collectivists and the individualists is not on the goals. Both groups want to see what is best for their fellow man. They want to see freedom and justice and security and tranquility. Both groups want to see that. But the collectivists want to see it through coercion. They want to see it through laws and force and with a cadre in control, making the decisions and adjusting portions of society so that some benefit at the expense of others, and manipulating and controlling human beings to bring about all these things. Whereas the individualist says, no, we believe in freedom of choice. We believe that the best way to achieve all these things is through voluntary action.
All right, fine. Well, let's take a real problem. Let's imagine that within our community there are a certain number of people that, we're going to not have federal Medicare or federal Medicaid programs. There are people who need medical care. There are people who need housing. There are people who really, truly are in need of food for one reason or another. Now, an awful lot of this, these people, you know, when they have the food drives, they're getting out of their Cadillac, you know, to fill up the trunk, you know, with the free food. But for the people who truly are in need, what are you going to do? How are you going to address their problem? Doesn't it have to be addressed collectively?
Well, it can be addressed collectively, but does that mean it has to be done by force? In other words, let's use the example of the Good Samaritan. Now, the Good Samaritan, we all know, helped the person who had been injured at the side of the road. He gave of his own resources, and he was charitable. Everybody says that was the correct response. Now, supposing the Good Samaritan instead had approached the next traveler on the road and used a knife and said, okay, you are going to give half of what you have in your purse to help this guy. And if you don't, I will kill you. And he said, well, wait a minute, he's not such a good Samaritan anymore. Now he's another bandit who simply claims to have a good cause in mind. And that is really what we're dealing with here. If it's voluntary action, it's very good. Charity is wonderful, but when it's not voluntary, when you force other people to do what you think they should do, whether they want to or not, now you've got the beginning of the concept of totalitarianism, because all totalitarian measures are always justified in the name of doing good for somebody or some group, all of them. And so once you accept that it's okay to injure one group or one individual for the benefit of another, you have accepted the basic premise of totalitarianism. And that's not acceptable to me.
All right, well, fine. Certainly your example is a beautiful one and very well put. But, of course, the idea of the Good Samaritan has its origin within a religious context.
Well, yes, but I'm using it in strictly a non-religious way. Just take the Good Samaritan out of the religious context and just say it's, you know, somebody in our community. You see somebody down the street living underneath the bridge, and you think, golly, this guy needs shelter. And then you have a choice of stopping in your car and giving him some money and maybe offering him to come into your home or whatever, giving him a job. You can do all of those things. Or you can go down to City Hall and say, I want to pass a law that will require everybody in this community to contribute some of their funds. And if we can get 51% of the people to agree to it, then we're going to use taxes to support this guy. Now, that's the same principle, you see. It's just ganging up. If you can get 51% of the people to agree to something, and you gang up on the other 49%, and you call it a law, and therefore it's okay. It's no different because it's a law than if it weren't a law. If you got three people that ganged up on one person and took his money away from him by force, in order to give it to somebody that you thought needed it, that's the same principle, whether it's a law written or not. It's the majority ganging up on the minority and claiming a good cause. Well, as I said before, they always claim a good cause. No totalitarian measure has ever been passed without being justified supposedly in the name of some kind of a good cause.
Okay, fine. Well, we're out of time, Ed. Do you have a departing thought for our listeners tonight?
Well, my departing thought is I thank you for anybody that stuck with us all this time, and I hope I planted a few good ideas, and I invite everyone who's interested in pursuing this more to come to our website, and that's www.freedom-force.org.
God bless you. Thanks so much, Ed. And I'm sure we'll be talking many, many more times.
Thank you, Stan. Good
Bye-bye.
Night.
Bye. Okay, fine. Well, that was, of course, Ed Griffin talking about his new concept, a new organization that he's trying to put together called Freedom Force. And so certainly I hope you've enjoyed the program. Long. I wanted you to have plenty of time to hear what Ed had to say. He's certainly one of the more perceptive people, and as they say, I've known him for 41 years. That's over half a lifetime, and he is a man of integrity. Anyway, this is the time when we have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we do hope that many of you out there will decide you're going to join the Radio Liberty family, because I believe that the only way we're going to really touch people's hearts is to reach them, to make them understand the nature of the struggle we're involved in, and the spiritual component of that struggle. So if you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. If you'd, of course, like a free copy of our latest newsletter, why, we'll be glad to send you one. My March newsletter deals with the secret group that surrounds and controls the presidency, and it's known as the Project for a New American Century. We tell you about their website, newamericancentury.org. We give you the quotations from their publications. These are really not very nice people. And certainly when you pull down the Rebuilding America's Defenses, they're going to tell you about the wonderful new biological weapons that we'll have that can actually eventually be used to target specific genus types. That means certain racial groups, and how these can be used not only for military, but for political purposes. In other words, we'll eliminate certain racial groups. We're dealing against organized evil. And I believe if we don't address the spiritual component, we're going to lose this battle. So we're out of time. Till tomorrow at the same time. Pray for America. Pray for our boys overseas. Pray for our ministers. Pray for revival in America, because if this country doesn't turn back to God, God will never again bless this country again. And lastly, we ask you to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. And so until next week at the same time, well, I guess tomorrow at the same time, Darcy Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you.
Yeah, it really was a little long.
One hour would have cut it.
Right. Anyway.
What was that?